And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. This is a podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet directly to your earbuds. And we have another treat, a guest that I've had on before, but he's one that I think ought to be on continuously, just as he is a continuous contributor to the Christian Research Journal. He's making an incredible impact on the lives of students, but more broadly, people in cultures around the world through his writings. And I'm really excited about the book that we want to focus in on today. It's a book titled Fire in the Streets, How You Can Confidently Respond to Incendiary Cultural Topics. My guest is Douglas Grootheis, and before I formally introduce him on the podcast today, I want to read just a couple of paragraphs from the front flap of the book. It starts out with these words: society appears to be burning down around us. A dangerous, a radical philosophy lurks behind the revolutionary movements that are even now convulsing America. And it has quietly made its way into almost every institution. I mean, that in itself is going to be part of the discussion today. Every institution, even our churches. In this compelling and accessible book, and I can guarantee you it is both compelling and accessible, Christian philosopher Douglas Grootheis reveals the many faces of critical theory. And in the process, he equips believers to recognize and confront critical theory. Well, what are the many faces? Well, Black Lives Matter, Antifa, critical race theory, social justice. The list of pathologies goes on. All are forms of a cultural Marxism that divides society into oppressors and the oppressed, depicting American history as a 400-year pageant of injustice. It is an ideology as toxic as it is false. And I think those two paragraphs in and of themselves are warrant to get this book. It is available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org. You can also write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Douglas Grootheis, who is the author of this incredible resource, is a professor of philosophy at Denver Seminary. He's an author of many books, including the book we're talking about right now. He's widely published in both scholarly and popular journals. I think I mentioned he's a frequent contributor to the Christian Research Journal. And this book is a must read because it's dealing with an ideology that has the power to burn down a culture that has made an impact around the world. This is about rescuing Western civilization. Doug, I'm delighted to have you on Hank Unplugged today.
Well, thank you. Happy to be back. You know, speaking of the Christian Research Journal, our departed friend Elliot Miller said that besides you, I had written more articles for the Christian Research Journal than anybody else. That was probably 15 years ago when he said that. So we've had a long standing relationship going way back to the Walter Martin days. So I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, your contributions have been immense. I want to start this podcast by asking a basic question. I think as much as we've talked about critical theory in America over the last few years, a lot of people don't have a handle on exactly what critical theory is, what it represents, and the threat that it is to Western civilization.
Right. It sounds good if you compare it to critical thinking. We should be critical thinkers. We should test truth claims through logic and evidence. We should be careful to not fall for logical fallacies or ideological platitudes and so on. However, the word critical theory ultimately goes back to Marxism. So Marx and Engels developed their revolutionary philosophy in the mid to late 19th century, and they believed that society was incessantly one of economic conflict, where the owners are oppressing and exploiting the workers. And eventually this would lead to a revolution in which the workers would overthrow the systems of power and create what was called a dictatorship of the proletariat. And eventually this would pass away and there would be no class divisions because the engine of oppression would be gone, namely private property and profit making. Now, if you fast forward some time to Frankfurt, Germany in the 20s and 30s, there were a group of Marxists, and everyone I'm talking about is an atheist. Marx and Engels said the critique of religion is the beginning of all social critique. They were ardent, adamant atheists and opponents of all religion, particularly Christianity. But if you fast forward to about the late 20s and 30s in Frankfurt, Germany, you had thinkers like Herbert Marcuse and Max Horkheimer, Erich Fromm, and others. And they realized that Marx and Engels' predictions had not come true, that the working class had not fomented revolution from the bottom up to overthrow the tyrannical landlords. There had been revolutionary and socialist activity, but it really didn't play out according to the Marxist account of things. So they said, well, we have to remain Marxists. We will remain atheists, but we need to deepen the critique. We need to go beyond economic exploitation and talk about cultural exploitation. So critical theory was developed as a type of updating Marxism. You can call it cultural Marxism or neo-Marxism. And people like Herbert Marcuse and others said that the level of oppression is far deeper than just property and profit. So if you are a person of color, you are intrinsically oppressed by any Western sort of democratic system. And if you are a person who is not of the sexual majorities, if you're a sexual minority, then you are oppressed also. So basically the idea was, let's broaden the net and talk not just about people who don't make a lot of money, the workers, but let's talk about those who are not conforming to typical mores of society about gender, and let's extend it also to people of color. And the idea is that the white, to use a more modern term, heteronormative majority are oppressing everyone else simply by virtue of being part of this group. So critical theory deals with groups. It doesn't deal with individuals as having unique value in the sight of God. That's a Christian view, and you cannot support that outside of a Christian or Jewish worldview. And remember, we're talking about atheists. So they see what they call injustice in society, and some of what they point out is right, but they don't understand the human condition, and they don't understand the strengths of a constitutional republic, as we have in the United States. So what you saw in the summer of 2020 with the George Floyd riots was the idea that America is fundamentally corrupt and it has to be torn down, even burned down, even literally burned down. And in the book, I quote an author who was interviewed on National Public Radio by the name of Vicki Osterweil. She wrote a book called In Defense of Looting. When I use the word looting, I mean the mass expropriation of property, mass shoplifting during a moment of upheaval or riot. That's the thing I'm defending. She says this on National Public Radio, which is supported by our tax dollars, and she was not given any challenge by the host. So the idea is that the whole structure of society is oppressive. Wealth is concentrated in white males mostly. And so if you don't have a great concentration of wealth, especially if you're poorer or you're a person of color, female, whatever, then you have a right to expropriate what has been taken from you. So there's no sense of property rights, no sense that the structures of American civilization can accommodate social change, such as the philosophy of the Declaration of Independence, that God has given us inalienable rights, such as the First Amendment, that we have freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of press, assembly, and so on. They really do want to fundamentally transform America because it is intrinsically and inexorably oppressive. So the term you hear is systemic racism. So I have a whole chapter on that in the book.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to get into the R in CRT. So you have CT, yeah. Then you have critical race theory. Maybe at a very basic level, define what the Marxists mean by race as opposed to a Christian talking about race.
Right. Well, critical theory somewhere along the line became critical race theory. The assumptions are still Marxist and still errant. But you have people like Derrick Bell, the legal scholar, who is an influence on Barack Obama, and Kimberly Crenshaw and others developing the racial aspect of it. But it's still essentially Marxist. So about 2 years ago, one of the leaders of Black Lives Matter came on YouTube and did a video, and she said, "We are trained Marxists." Now you might be thinking, what does that mean, trained Marxist? Would someone admit being an untrained Marxist? What she means is we're activists, we're revolutionaries. We want to bring down the whole system, right? So the idea is that if you are Black, you are oppressed. If you are Latino, Latina, you are oppressed. There's this general category of people of color are oppressed simply by being who they are. So it's neo-Marxism or cultural Marxism with a very strong racial component added to the economic component. And the Marxists, ever since day one, have tried to enlist disenfranchised minorities. The Communist Party, for decades and decades, tried to enlist African Americans to their cause in the United States and pretty much failed. But they're looking for people who are discontent, maybe haven't done that well in society, and they capitalize on resentment and envy and a fix that seems just and seems right, which is not a fix at all, which is to burn down the system, destroy private property, destroy the profit motive, have everything controlled by the state, who will equitably bring about social peace and equality and so on. And where Marxism has taken hold around the world, it never has done that. Let's think of the Soviet Union and Lenin's use of Marxism and the use of Marxism by Mao Zedong in China or Pol Pot in Cambodia or the Castros in Cuba or what's going on now in Venezuela. Marxism never ennobles or empowers people. It oppresses people. In fact, it tends to kill people. Some estimate that 100 million people were killed by their own civil governments in the 20th century through Marxism. 100 million. That's in the Black Book of Communism that came out about 20 years ago. Now, why is that? It's because there's no God. It's a thoroughly godless worldview. So there's no fear of God. So what matters is political revolution and this idea of some future utopia. So if you're not with the revolutionary vanguard, that is, if you're not one of the trained Marxists, then you suffer from what they call false consciousness. You don't understand the world, and you can't be talked out of your viewpoint. You have to be silenced. To use our language now, you have to be canceled. But cancellation can get very serious in terms of imprisonment, even in terms of execution. So it is not the American ideal of a marketplace of ideas. However imperfectly we work that out in our history, we have the First Amendment, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, all right? Critical race theory does not hold to that as an ideal. In fact, it thinks that's a fraud. That's a joke, because the people that wrote the Declaration of Independence and wrote the Constitution were white slave owners. So that in itself just discredits the whole thing as a farce, which it does not, because what they wrote was generally true and significant. And sometimes people can write better than they live. Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, was conflicted about slavery. In many ways, he wanted to free slaves, but there are a lot of historical pressures on him. And
a lot of political pressures too.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. So what critical race theory does is it gives a storyline for America, race, economics, and justice. It's pretty simplistic. It's easy to understand. And if you understand it, you get angry, especially if you are a person of color. But even if you're a white person, a lot of what drives all this is what the Black historian Shelby Steele calls white guilt. A lot of liberal white folks just feel guilty by virtue of being white. They've been the recipients of unjust privilege and benefits. And so they want to radically rearrange society, destroy the free market, take away freedom of speech in order to empower those who have supposedly been systemically oppressed. And my basic vision in this book is that because of the fall, human beings do exploit each other, and racism exists because of the fall. There's exactly one human race. God made everyone from one man. There's one God, one human race, two genders. We're all fallen, one savior. Let's do the math on these things, all right? So there's not a multiplicity of races. There's one race with different histories, different backgrounds, different nations of origin and all these things. And so a Christian view says that we are all made in the image and likeness of God. So we bear unique, irreducible value. We have a philosophical reason to hold that. And we also believe that every human being is selfish and sinful. So people will gain for themselves and people like them unjust power. But in the United States, we have a history of addressing these things. Think of the sad situation in the Civil War. We had about 250,000 Union troops died to free the slaves in the Civil War. Think of the civil rights movement to deal with the inequities of the Jim Crow period. And think of the betterment of people of color in the United States. We had an African-American president for two terms. Whether you liked him or not, the fact that he was elected, I think, was very significant. So the Black Lives Matter people say things like the civil rights movement was really a sham. It didn't accomplish very much that was good at all. People like Derrick Bell will say that. So critical race theory, Black Lives Matter people will say it's not radical enough. So you see, Martin Luther King believed in American ideals. When he spoke at the Capitol in 1963 or four, he talked about the magnificent documents of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And he said, we're here to hold America accountable to the ideals of these documents. He didn't say burn it down. He didn't say the system is corrupt. He didn't say America is based on slavery, so we have to destroy it and start over again. He was trying to reclaim the brilliance of these American founding principles. But don't be deceived. The people who are animated by critical race theory, the Black Lives Matter people, the Antifa people, do not hold that at all.
I think it's correct to say that Marx coined the word capitalism. Given the fact that we are intrinsically selfish, we're sinful, why is capitalism the right way to go? Why did Marx coin this in a pejorative sense, and we're talking about it in a positive sense, particularly if you add the word Christian capitalism, responsibility associated with wealth?
Right. I believe Marx did coin that term, and I prefer to use the word free enterprise or the free market system. For example, when AOC was asked why she was a socialist, she said, well, just think of the words. Capitalism is about money. It's about greed. It's about acquisitiveness, and socialism is about being social and loving people. So we got to go a little deeper than that. The free market is based on the assumption that human beings should have private property, and that there's such a thing as property rights, and that the best economic arrangement is one of generally free exchange among consenting parties. Now, in a fallen world, that's not going to work out perfectly, of course. However, one of the ingenious aspects of the free market, as Adam Smith pointed out, is that even when people are selfish, they often supply goods and services to others anyway. So let's say someone like Bill Gates did everything he did for selfish reasons. I'm not saying he did. Still, look at the products that he produced, the jobs he produced, the opportunities he produced. The problem with socialism is it concentrates political and economic power in the state. And the state has a monopoly on legitimate violence. So the state can say, give us this much tax money. And you can't say, I'm sorry, I don't feel like it today. The state can conscript you into military service. The state can arrest you. The state can come in and take your documents, right? So when you start to concentrate economic power in the state, it always limits liberties. And moreover, it's not an efficient system for the exchange of goods and services. We need price mechanisms in order to eliminate scarcity and so on. So on paper, it just sounds so good. Well, so many people are disadvantaged by the greedy capitalist system. So we need to adjust everything to become more equitable. And I'd say, well, how are you going to do that exactly? And how has that fared in other countries around the world? And what is the dark side of all this? And the dark side of it is state power. It's called statism, essentially. So I have a chapter in the book called Should We Torch the Free Market? Because critical race theory is socialist. Someone like Ibrahim X. Kendi, who's very popular, charges a lot more per speaking engagement than I do and gets it, says that capitalism is intrinsically racist. So anytime you have capitalism, you have racism. No, racism comes out of the fall. And you find racists in socialist countries, monarchies, free market oriented countries. It's not the result of capitalism by any means. In fact, capitalism, if you want to use that word, I'd rather say free market, gives people opportunities to advance. And even during the Jim Crow period, which was unjust and wrong legally in the United States, many African Americans, and Bob Munson has pointed this out, developed parallel cultures, parallel institutions. They were segregated, so they developed schools, they developed businesses using their own fortitude, ingenuity, and grit, even though they were oppressed, and they should not have been, through the Jim Crow period. But they had some economic opportunities to create parallel institutions. I'm not arguing for this, but I'm saying that when you leave people to their own creative abilities, you let them exchange goods and services. And of course, you have the enforcement of contracts, and you might need antitrust laws. That gets very complicated. But the bottom line here is that you do not create a racially just society through socialism. That is not the answer.
Why are so many young people buying into socialism, given what you have just said? You have the famine, you have the slaughter, you have the destabilization of societies, you have the 100 million that you alluded to, and now with the gradual opening of the Chinese archives, we're finding out that 100 million is actually understating the problem significantly. Why is it that today's youth are buying into this in mass? Obviously, you're an educator, and you know how this bad ideology has permeated the institutions, including Christian institutions, but particularly educational institutions, environmental institutions, entertainment institutions, etc. Yeah.
Right. Well, there are two things. First is just rank ignorance. A lot of young people don't know world history. They don't know the history of the 20th century. They don't know the history of philosophy, political ideology. They haven't understood Marx and Engels, and they haven't seen what Lenin did in the Soviet Union, what Mao Zedong did in China. So a lot of it is ignorance. The other part is a smokescreen where people will say, oh, we want democratic socialism. We don't want Marxist totalitarianism. We want the best of both worlds. Well, when you look at the leaders in critical race theory and Black Lives Matter and so on, they go right back to Marx and Engels. They go back to, we need revolution, and we will do what it takes to have revolution. But I'd even point to some countries in Europe that are supposedly these great models of socialism and say, well, how much economic freedom do they have? How much political freedom do they have in those countries? One thing about America, there are many unique things about America, and I defend American exceptionalism in my book, is that you have opportunities for advancement you typically don't have elsewhere, even if you are discriminated against, all right? Let me give you a personal example. A friend of mine knew a family that moved to the United States from France. And the reason they moved is that the man had reached a certain level of achievement in his profession. And because of the taxation structure and the socialist government, he couldn't do any better. He had reached a plateau. So they moved to the United States, where he could use his abilities much more freely and develop more wealth and use his gifts with greater liberty. So when people say, well, we want democratic socialism, And it's just unfair that so few people have so much money. Let's do some economics 101. I dedicated my book to one of my intellectual heroes, who is Thomas Sowell. And I've been reading Thomas Sowell for 40 years. He's an economist, historian, African-American, former Marxist, interestingly, and he's written a great critique of Marxism. But the people that clamor for socialism don't understand how economics works. They have this airy, fairy ideal of a perfect society or a much more equitable society. And if we just mean well, and we have this, what Sowell calls the vision of the anointed, you have these people that say, well, it's tax the rich, give to the poor, make sure we don't have capital accumulating and have the government in control of this. It's unworkable. And every economic system east of Eden will have wealth differentials. And in fact, they're not intrinsically wrong. So, you know, back to Bill Gates, and I'm no big fan of Bill Gates, but he's a very wealthy man. He's brought a lot of good into the world through his enterprise, right? Even if he was selfish, he's provided goods and services for many people. And for all I know, Bill Gates never broke the law in doing so. So has he taken anything from anybody? Has Elon Musk stolen anything from anybody? Well, maybe there could be a court case against him or something. But my point is that in a free market situation, you can make a tremendous amount of money developing industries, services, and all the rest of it. But typically, really wealthy people don't just hold on to their money and stuff it into 100 mattresses. They invest it. And when they invest it, that creates economic opportunity for other people. When you make everything controlled by the state is not alert and receptive to what's going on the ground. And Thomas Sowell has some terrific examples of this in the old Soviet Union, where there wasn't a market to allocate goods and services. It was all from the top down. So you had warehouses full of goods, like full of tractors, and a few hundred miles away, farmers didn't have any tractors to use. Why? There was no market mechanism to share the information and bring the goods and services where they belong. So a lot of left-wing critical race theory ideas about justice and economics are based on a fundamental ignorance of how markets work, and also a fundamental ignorance that even greed, and greed is a sin according to scripture, according to Jesus, even greed works better in a free market than it works in a socialist setting. Because greed can produce good effects in a free market situation, where in a socialist situation, you have the bureaucrats that get all the power, all the money, and they have it and they enforce it on everybody else, and they can't go broke. You know, they can't fail to compete in the market because they're not in a market. They're just bureaucrats with power from the top down. So one of the burdens of my book is to argue for the free market from a Christian viewpoint, from a historical, from an economic viewpoint.
Talk about some of the people that you mentioned in the conversation thus far, Herbert Marcuse, and the impact he had on Angela Davis, and Angela Davis on Black Lives Matter, etc.
Right. Well, Marcuse came to the United States, I believe, in the 30s to escape Hitler, and he was given a warm and receptive domicile here, I believe, at Columbia to start with, and then he ended up at the University of California at Berkeley. And was very popular back in the day. He had a book called One Dimensional Man that was a bestseller. He was giving a new version of Marxism that was really the animating force of what was called the New Left back in the day. In fact, the old phrase, make love, not war, is probably traceable to him, because he said, we're not just economically oppressed, we're sexually oppressed. So he combined a kind of libertarian view of Freud with Marx to say, Americans are sexually oppressed, and this is part of the economic structure of oppression. So freedom means not only spreading the wealth around, it also means engaging in all this pent-up sexuality to experience true freedom and liberation. And he was chiming in with the thoughts of Wilhelm Reich and others. So all this really works together. Now, one of his mentees was Angela Davis, the African-American activist, and she became a professor, one of the many tenured radicals. And the Black Lives Matter folks will say that she was a mentor to them. So I've got a book up on my shelf somewhere by Patricia Cullors. She's one of the Black Lives Matter founders. I'm not sure if she's still with the group. And it has a foreword by Angela Davis. So you go Marx and Engels, Marcuse, Angela Davis, Black Lives Matter, throw in Derrick Bell with legal theory, Derrick Bell, who influenced Barack Obama significantly. And while Barack Obama wanted to present himself as a moderate and a mediating figure, he really wasn't. He was really quite committed to a lot of these critical race theory ideas. And now we're seeing those things come to fruition just with a vengeance in the Biden administration, because the first day or the first week President Biden was in office, he said, "We support the diversity, equity, inclusion agenda," which is essentially critical race theory, just another word for critical race theory.
In your book, you offer a crash course on media discernment, and I think this is worthwhile cashing out in the podcast.
Yeah. Well, our problems go very deep in the United States, and part of it is how we access information about society. I've already talked about the problem of ignorance. People are not taught the history of philosophy, the history of socialism, and so on. So they're, you might say, well-informed because they have factoids coming at them constantly, and they're very agitated about the information they have, but are they really knowledgeable about what's going on in history and what is happening today? So I've been very influenced by Neil Postman, the media critic who wrote one of the best books I've ever read called Amusing Ourselves to Death. I just recommended that to a young friend of mine, and he instantly read it. I was so happy. And he said, "This is so relevant to what's going on." So whenever we are receiving information through a medium, we have to ask, what can that medium do well and what does it not do well? So let's say Twitter. Well, Twitter will tell you someone's opinion right away. You have it instantly. But it usually doesn't go very deep. You only have a certain number of characters to communicate it. Any visual medium, television, films, whatever it is, will privilege the image over the word. Now, that's fine for films, and that can be significant and helpful to have the image. Sometimes the image will distract from the rational issues at hand. People are overwhelmed or humiliated by the image, and they're not thinking through facts, logic, and they're not thinking philosophically about things. So the example I use is the George Floyd video, the 9 minutes of him being arrested and him dying under the knee of Derek Chauvin. What set off the riots was not a measured reflection on how a policeman was dealing with a Black man resisting arrest. It was, "I can't breathe, and a white man has his knee on the neck of a Black man." And this supposedly symbolized and encapsulated the whole American system, right? A white man, a white police officer, having his knee on the back of a Black man who dies. And that narrative, as we use that word all the time, that narrative literally set America on fire. Now, I'm not defending what Derek Chauvin did. However, we have to look at the deeper facts here. George Floyd was resisting arrest. He was high on fentanyl. He was crying out, "I can't breathe," before they used the compliance hold. An ambulance had been called. This is not a rank case of a white man hating a Black man and killing him. In fact, the prosecution, given the data I had when I wrote the book, the prosecution wasn't even claiming racism. They're just claiming police misconduct, and he was convicted of some form of murder, right? But the whole narrative was that these few minutes encapsulate and crystallize what America is all about. And so they put it into this larger picture of police brutality, systemic racism. And I'd say, wait a minute, we've got some minutes of video. We don't have the backstory. What about the facts about white on Black police violence? What are they? Can we show from the evidence that this is a systemic, terrible problem? So bad that you have to burn down police stations and say, let's defund the police. And the answer to that is emphatically not. I cite Heather McDonald's book, The War on Cops. I cite Wilfred Riley's book, Hate Crime Hoax. But you see, the image, and especially of an image of a man dying, is so powerful that it eclipses any rational consideration of the background evidence. So if we're going to be wise as Christians and seeking the welfare of the city where God has placed us, we need to know the facts on the ground. And we don't want to be reactionary to this. You've got to do some research here. So that's why I wrote the book. I wanted to give people more background, more history, more facts, more logic, put it in a biblical framework. The book's about 250 pages and 500 footnotes. So as J.P. Moreland said in his endorsement, if you disagree with what Doug says, then present a better viewpoint. Calling me names is not an argument. That's just an ad hominem fallacy.
I want you to unpack the contradiction of major corporations giving millions, perhaps we could say billions of dollars, to organizations that are destructive to America, despite the fact that these organizations, we mentioned Black Lives Matter, they set themselves in direct opposition to capitalism in general and Christian capitalism in particular.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is an odd phenomenon, isn't it? Because if you go back 10, 20 years, you might say that corporate America was more conservative, more Republican, and liberals were more anti-business, and so on. But now there's something that people call woke capitalism. And a lot of the leaders of these major corporations like Facebook, Twitter, and so on, are very far left. Now, they made their millions and billions of dollars off of a relatively free market, but they feel an intense kind of guilt for the system, perhaps white guilt. And so they want to empower these groups that are supposedly bringing about more racial justice. But this is really more like what is called crony capitalism, which is not truly a free market arrangement. Crony capitalism is where people want to keep their property, make a lot of profit, get special favors from the civil government, and then support left-wing causes, but they don't completely endorse socialism. They want their money. They want to be able to use their money to support left-wing causes. They might endorse left-wing candidates and so on. But at the end of the day, do they really want to divest themselves of all their money and share the wealth with the poor? No, they don't.
I want you to talk a little bit. You mentioned critical race versus critical thinking. So much of what we are digesting today is a function of sloganeering and propaganda and party cliches and so forth. So we don't think anymore. We respond to these short little monikers, and we've lost the ability to analyze things critically. The very thing you said about George Floyd, if you look at the entirety of the video, you get a different impression than if you just get the narrative in a short clip. Or you get a slogan.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. Christians should be transformed through the renewing of their minds, Paul says in Romans 12. And in our thinking, we should be mature. And Jesus said, the greatest commandment is to love the Lord our God with our heart, soul, strength, and mind. God says through Isaiah, come let us reason together, says the Lord. So Christians of all people should be the sharpest, clearest, most well-informed thinkers out there. And that means we're going to see through a lot of the cliches, the factoids, the talking points. And we might have to say some things that are not well received, but we need to back it up with the facts. We need to cite the scripture. We need to defend the Christian worldview. We've been doing that for so long, Hank, with apologetics and challenging the cults and other religions and giving the scientific, philosophical, historical evidence for the Christian faith. So there's no room for being an intellectual slacker if you're a Christian. We really should try to outthink the world for Christ. And if you can't outthink the world by using facts, logic, and evidence in a humble way, then you're out of chops. That's what God has given us to influence the world, is facts, logic, the power of the Spirit, humility, courage. And we can't avert to propaganda, deception, anything like that.
You spent some time talking about the 1619 Project. This is a classic case of idea laundering, where you have things that look as though they're credible through peer review, Pulitzer Prize, etc. But in reality, this is a completely distorted concept of the DNA of Western civilization, but more particularly of America.
Right. And that narrative is necessary to the critical race account of America, because if America is essentially good and allows for reform over time, then there's no reason to burn it all down. But if it's intrinsically corrupt, then it has to be destroyed root and branch. So the 1619 Project was originally an insert in the New York Times in 2019. I remember getting it because I used to get the Sunday New York Times hard copy. I was looking through it and I thought, they're claiming 1619 is the real founding of America and the Declaration of Independence is a fraud. The Constitution is racist. I thought, well, that's just absurd. This is not going to get any traction. Well, I was sure wrong about that. The traction really came a year later after the George Floyd death. In fact, the principal architect of the 1619 Project, Hannah Jones, forgot her first name.
Nicole
Hannah Jones, said that the 2020 riots were the 1619 riots, and she was proud of that. So you have to consider some things here about the 1619 Project. It was an insert, I think about 100-page insert in the New York Times. It had no documentation. It was not peer-reviewed. And it cast a different vision of America as originally, institutionally, systemically oppressive. Everything about America is based on slavery, right? That's the controlling storyline. And it was attacked even by left-wing people. In my book, I document a group of Trotskyites. You know, Trotskyites were the ones that lost in the Russian Revolution because Lenin's men took over. But a group of Trotskyites wrote a whole book against the 1619 Project because it's such bad history. And I think you have a guest coming on to talk about this in more detail. They did come out with a full book right around the time I was finishing my book. So I didn't have time to read that whole book and critique it. But suffice to say, while slavery is a terrible blight on America, the whole system of the United States is not based philosophically or economically on slavery. And moreover, slavery is not anything unique to white people or to Americans. Slavery happens because of the fall. And various groups of people have enslaved others throughout world history. Thomas Sowell has written on this. There were even Blacks in the United States who owned Black slaves. I document that. Thomas Sowell has written about that. Racism is wrong. Slavery was wrong. But America was able to overcome that. And moreover, it wasn't that all of America was always pro-slavery. We had the North and we had the South. So the storyline of the 1619 Project is aimed to overthrow and discredit America, qua America. That is, America as America has to be overcome, has to be destroyed. And I say, no, America is a good idea. We are an exceptional nation, and we have been able to reform ourselves on the basis of our best principles over time. And there was a Black conservative radio host and author some years ago, I think he's retired, named Ken Hamblin. He was out of Denver. He wrote a book with this great title called Find a Better Country. I don't think you can find a better country than the United States. That's no pass for present problems, for past injustices. But really, do you want to live in Cuba? Do you want to live in China? Do you want to live in Venezuela? Do you even want to live in France where your opportunities are going to be restricted through the socialism? I don't think so. I hope not, anyway.
I think one of the points that you made earlier on in this podcast is the need to know history, the need to know the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, what the Revolutionary War was about, what the Civil War was about. Even though those things seem so basic, I would guess that most Americans today are illiterate when it comes to the basics.
Well, I agree. And so in the book, I advocate for homeschooling, Christian schools, classical private schools. Some charter schools have a high level of education that's not completely woke. My son-in-law Christian Idem works in one of those schools in Fair Oaks, California. It's called the John Adams Charter School. So we have to think in terms of future generations. We have to educate people in terms of critical thinking, logic, rhetoric. What does the Bible teach? How do we defend the Bible? What is America about? What happened with the Constitution? What does the Constitution say? What is the amendment process? What happened in the civil rights movement? And just get smart. You know, I'm an educator, I'm a professor, so I spend all my time reading and studying, but you don't have to be a professor to get smart on some of these basic issues. You know, if you want the really big picture of how Christianity relates to Western civilization, I would read Francis Schaeffer's book, How Should We Then Live? It came out in 1976. It's a classic to get a very broad-based, broad-brush kind of perspective of the development of Western history, Francis Schaeffer and his other books. And I try in my book to give you the basis of the American experiment, American exceptionalism, the moral basis for a free market, the significance of free speech. I have one chapter called The Christian Framework, which is explicitly apologetics. There are some folks that are very anti-critical race theory who are atheists. People like Peter Boghossian and James Lindsley, I think Lindsley and his co-author Helen Pluckrose are atheists. They really have nothing to base their critique on. They say we need to value the individual. Freedom of speech is important to find truth. They say, wait a minute, you need a Christian worldview to ground those ideas. If you're an atheist, we're here for no reason. There's no reason to think our intellectual equipment even connects to reality. And why not just be involved in various power games? Survival of the fittest, essentially. So I critique atheism as an inadequate support for historic Western and American liberties. And I say that a Christian worldview gives us a realistic understanding of the human condition. We're great by virtue of being made in God's image, and we are fallen by virtue of what happened in Genesis 3, that the human race is east of Eden. But we're still made in the image and likeness of God. We still have value. And it's far better to have a society where you give people freedom of speech and a limited government than any kind of socialistic false utopianism.
You know, if you don't know the Constitution, then you are ripe for the picking. You can buy into all kinds of myths. There's a prevalent myth that's being communicated that according to the Constitution, black people count as 3/5 of a human being. Well, if you don't know the truth, you're going to buy the lie, particularly when it's communicated over and over again.
Oh, it is all the time. I've even seen this in conservative books claiming this. And I spend, I think, 4 or 5 pages on it. To understand what's going on, you need to understand something of the history. So the Constitution was written in order for the North and the South to have a compact. And if they didn't have some kind of document that defined who they were, you would have had a Northern nation and a Southern nation, one free and one slave. So the South wanted their slaves to count as one for representation in the legislature, even though, of course, they couldn't vote, but they wanted every slave, and the word slave is never used in the Constitution. Race is not even used in the Constitution. It's used in the Southern Constitution, which lost out, thank God. But the idea was the North said, well, we will give you 3/5 of a vote for every enslaved person. And the South agreed to that. It's sad that there had to be a compromise, but it's a compromise. It's not a statement of principle. We as the United States believe that African Americans are 3/5 the value of a white person. That is not any part of it whatsoever. It was a compromise. And actually, the North was trying to limit the voting power of the South by not giving them the full voting power of the slaves who were not allowed to vote anyway. So, you know, the congressmen are chosen on the basis of the population of the state. And the South wanted to count their slave population. So they wanted to have all the representation of the slaves. And the North said, we don't want you to have that much power. We'll give you 3/5. I go into quite a bit of detail about that. But what you hear is America is originally, systemically, institutionally oppressive. The white founders and the white writers of the Constitution thought blacks were worth 3/5 of a human being. Well, I'll give you a good German word, Bullgeschichte. It's just not true.
It's so interesting today. Well, sad, I suppose. You have Jefferson, the apostle of liberty. You have Lincoln, the great emancipator. They were trying to negotiate the tension between emancipation and saving the Union. Today, right. You have students, lots of woke individuals spraying graffiti on their statues or altogether destroying or bringing them down. I mean, it's such an irony. And I think to your point, it demands that we educate at least the Christian, and then the Christian has to be salt and light as opposed to being in closed communities that don't really make an impact on the culture.
Well, exactly. In the final chapter of the book, I chart out a kind of Christian philosophy of citizenship and of civic participation. And I spend quite a bit of time on the need for distinctively Christian education and the need for understanding who we are as a nation and the significance. I talk about having fire in your bones for what's right, for the gospel, and then for the good of America, and having love in our hearts to not sink to propaganda and deception and name calling. So we need to have fire in our bones, love in our hearts, and then we need knowledge in our minds. We need zeal and knowledge, not knowledge without zeal and not zeal without knowledge. We need both. And we are accountable to what we know, and we're accountable to know what's significant. So I'm hoping that this book will help educate people into the real roots of critical race theory, what it's all about. You can't square it with scripture. You can't square it with good logic. You can't square it with American history. And I'm hoping that people will be challenged to, as I say, present a better fire. The fire of critical race theory is unholy fire. It's revolution. It's destruction. It's a kind of reverse racism, really. And the holy fire is the fire of do all things to the glory of God, love your neighbor, engage in social action for the good of everyone, don't pit one group against another, and so on. So I'm very concerned about what's happening in our country, Hank, and I know you are too. So I ended up writing this book fairly quickly. I wrote it in 4 months.
Oh my goodness.
And I was able to find a publisher right away, but I was very motivated and very enthusiastic to get this book out there, because when I started thinking about writing the book, I was in rural Alaska. And my wife, Kathleen, and I thought maybe we should just stay there. I teach at Denver Seminary and I'm in Denver most of the year. But in the summer of 2020, when the whole country was blowing up, we thought maybe we should just stay here for a few years until things calmed down. I could teach by Zoom for the seminary. So I called up a number of my friends in Denver, pastors and others, and I said, do you think it's safe to come back? That shows how severe things were. And that's not something that is simply in the past. That kind of thing can happen again. We're already seeing all kinds of violence against pregnancy centers in the United States after the Dobbs decision. A lot of people's first recourse when they're upset politically now is violence.
You mentioned earlier Ibram Kendi. You have now this reverse racism taking place, and it has been sanitized by people like Ibram Kendi. You have people in the Black Lives Movement saying that white skin is subhuman. White people are a genetic defect of blackness. There is this reverse racism. It's absolutely repugnant, and yet people of color can say this, whereas if you're white, you're sort of erased from the conversation. You can't really comment on it because you're an oppressor.
Right. Well, it's really toxic to any kind of civil discourse or good logical argumentation, because you don't win an argument because you're white, yellow, red, green, or anything else. You win an argument because you're using facts well. You're using premises that reach a conclusion. And truth is not pigmented. Logic is not pigmented. Mathematics is not pigmented. And sure, people in power have abused their power. We've seen that in the United States throughout history. But that is a problem of the whole human race. It's not just a problem for white people or any other particular pigmented group of people. And when you start to say that, well, only people of color can speak to this, or they know because of their lived experience, then you've left the realm of facts, logic, and inquiry. The idea is, well, if I'm a Black person or a Latino or something else, then I just know the way the world is, and I know that I'm oppressed, and you have to shut up and listen to me. Well, this is just so wrong in so many ways. Now, I don't know what it's like to be discriminated against because I'm Black, because I'm not Black. I don't know what it's like to be pulled over, let's say, by a policeman when I've done nothing wrong because I'm Black. I'm not Black. So that's a lived experience I don't have. And I try to listen to my friends who have had experiences like that, and I try to sympathize with them, right? But just because you're yellow, Black, red, whatever it is, doesn't mean you have the last word on politics, economics, history, the American founding, the Three-Fifths Clause, right? You've got to do some research on those kinds of things. And so often I hear people saying, well, you've got to revert to the lived experience of oppressed people. And I say, yes, we need to listen to what they say, be sensitive, be aware. But simply because you feel oppressed, or even if you are oppressed, that doesn't make you an intellectual expert on the whole panoply of issues related to race, economics, and politics in America. There's one critic I quote in my book who's an African American. He was criticizing, I believe it was Kendi or someone else, who said they have an epistemology by being. The idea is that, well, if you are Black or if you are Hispanic, then just by being that, you have knowledge of the way the world is. And this writer was pointing out how absurd that is. If you want to justify a truth claim, you need something to back it up. You don't simply yell louder and give your bona fides as a so-called oppressed person. So the answer to racism is not more racism. The answer to inequality is not more inequality. It's opportunity. So I just shamelessly advocate for meritocracy. You know, the historic and American ideal, what Martin Luther King believed, that all men are created equal. And so we should give people equal opportunities and disallow anything structurally that's going to inhibit people's opportunities. But trying to ensure statistically representative outcomes is not wise. So if you say you have 13% of Americans who are Black, therefore we need 13% of Americans as airline pilots. Well, what causes the discrepancy? I'd say 50 years ago, racism would be a big part of that. Probably not today. There are all kinds of reasons. So Thomas Sowell has been writing about this for years. It's just really weak and pitiful social science to think that if you don't have statistical representation by way of racial percentages, that racism is the explanation. That's what Kendi says.
Help us understand the difference between equality and equity. These words are being used, and oftentimes people don't understand what's behind the term equity.
Yeah, equity means proportional outcomes. So if you talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, you say, well, we have professors, or we have police officers, or we have pilots, and if we don't have 13% African Americans or 11% Hispanics, then the default explanation is racism. And that's where things go wrong, because there's so many social factors that create different representation. One of them, as Thomas Sowell points out, is average age. So go to economic achievement for a minute. The average age of a Japanese American is 51, I believe. So if you're 51, you've probably gathered quite a bit of wealth, you've had various jobs and so on. The average age of a Black person in the US is in the 20s. So if you're talking about average income or achievement, you've got to look at things like age. How long have people been finding jobs, making money, developing their career? You also have to consider things like self-selection. You see this in something like nursing. Most nurses are women. Does that mean that men are being discriminated against? Probably not. Jordan Peterson has pointed out this kind of thing. So the Kendi approach is, if we don't have perfect representation across the board, for the ideal fields, then racism is the cause. And because racism is the cause, we need to discriminate against whites in order to elevate people of color. So we have to make race and ethnicity and sex primary. And the idea of ability and achievement ends up being secondary. This kind of idea has been at work in affirmative action in the United States for 50, 60 years. But equity is basically affirmative action on steroids. We are going to guarantee certain outcomes. And I was just reading an article by Heather McDonald in City Journal, put out by the Manhattan Institute. And she is saying that these ideas of equity are now being used in medical schools. Whoa. I mean, in medical schools, we need to test and educate according to objective standards of competence. And what she points out is that because the representation in medical schools or among physicians is not the percentage that the critical race theory people want, that the standards are starting to be lowered. Now, for one thing, that's an insult, I think, to people of color. Well, we have to somehow lower the standards, or the standards are supposedly intrinsically racist, so we have to change them so they're no longer racist. But in areas like that, airline pilots, medicine, you have to have a meritocracy, period. Not to have a meritocracy is just insane and actually dangerous.
Yeah. If you did an autopsy on affirmative action, what would you find?
Well, yeah, that's a big question, probably bigger than I can answer very thoroughly. But I hold the view held by Thomas Sowell, African-American economist, Shelby Steele, African-American historian, that affirmative action was really not a good idea for African-Americans. The late Walter Williams believed the same, because it takes something you're born with and brings it to the level of ability. The original affirmative action goal was not to put race above ability. And I quote that in my book. It was to make sure everything is fair and to try to recruit as broadly as possible to bring in minorities or people of color into various opportunities. It wasn't to give someone an advantage because they happen to be Hispanic or Black. It was to truly give opportunity to everyone to excel. But what that has turned into is making sex and race and now sexual identity primary, and not making merit and ability primary. I mean, we have ideas like a level playing field. Let's have a level playing field. And people who hold to the critical race theory perspective and the far left would say, oh, that's a myth. Level playing field is just racism under another image. We need to actively discriminate in order to bring people of color into these positions, even if that means changing standards in medical school, changing standards of aviation. I say, this is really getting absurd.
It is getting absurd.
Let's just let people achieve according to their abilities. And that's fine, because races are not in hierarchies. We're all created in the image and likeness of God. And let's try to allow people to achieve according to their opportunities and abilities, and not try to jerry-rig the system to get proportional representation irrespective of merit. It's not a good idea.
How does CRT, critical race theory, oppose the American ideal of freedom of speech?
Well, it's because they hold to their view in an ideological way. So the notion is that race and class control how you think and how you interact with the world. So there really is no rational discourse that is a good idea to find the truth. So one group is part of the revolutionary vanguard. They have their lived experience, they have their historical oppression, and they know the way reality is. And anything opposing that, like the views that I give in this book, are attributable then to racism. So a lot of this goes back again to Herbert Marcuse. He wrote an essay, I believe, in the 1970s called Repressive Tolerance. And he was the philosopher of the New Left. He's very influential in critical race theory, Black Lives Matter, and so on. We've talked about him earlier. And the idea is that you don't want to give equal access to oppressors. That just furthers their oppressive strategies. So you don't even want to tolerate people who are toxic. You want to silence them. And this is not the idea of may the best argument win, or something like John Stuart Mill, who said, if you only know your own view, you probably don't know it very well. You need to know other views as well as your own view to really comprehend what you believe and why. This is basically, there's one side that has it right because of their ethnicity or their sexual identity, and the other side is wrong, and we don't have to argue with them. We don't have to provide better support for our view. We don't have to even critique their view. We just want to silence them or cancel them. I'm seeing this all over. It's very dangerous because it's replacing the ideal of civil discourse with the ideal of ideological control. That's why I've got this t-shirt on that says, think while it's still legal. And I've got some other protest kind of t-shirts. I'm a philosopher and I'm a Christian. And Jesus said, if you're truly my disciples, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. Well, the best way to know the truth is by being a critical thinker and by listening to the views of other people. And when we do apologetics, we listen to the best arguments from the atheists, the Muslims, the Buddhists. We give a Christian response to those arguments. And we should do the same thing, whether it's in economics, politics, education. And to just shut down the other side because you label it as toxic or transphobic, homophobic, Christian haters, whatever it is not good for the country. It's not good for anybody. And we're seeing this with woke capitalists just taking people off of platforms and statements being issued that we shouldn't even let pro-life people have a voice in the media. I don't have the details on that, but I just read an article on that recently. And, you know, this goes way back. I mean, it goes back to Marcuse, repressive tolerance, but it's like the Marcuse bonfire has been burning and kind of smoldering for a long time. And now it's just everywhere. The flames are leaping up everywhere. And there's no pretense that, well, we value free speech, but we just don't like your speech. No, it's basically free speech is a myth of the white oppressive system, and we don't have to follow it. And we will shut you down. We'll take you off the platform. We will cast aspersions upon you, and you're not even worth listening to anymore. So I have a whole chapter on that, on ideology and free speech.
I just want your gut level assessment of where we are and whether you see hope. And even if you don't see hope, why we have to continue to be vigilant in this battle. We have to continue writing books like this, talking about the issues. Just your assessment.
I don't really know. I do know that Christians are called to be faithful as followers of Jesus, to live out the gospel, proclaim it, defend it, and we should be ideal citizens in our country and try to speak the truth in love, however and wherever we can. I think we're in a very bad way in the United States. That's why I wrote this book. This is actually my first book of political and social criticism. It's all directed to the situation in the United States. My other books have touched on those things, but they've been more in the area of philosophy and apologetics and cults and things like that. But I felt a real urgency to write this book. And it comes out of many years of studying American history and economics and politics and so on. So it really didn't take me that long to write, because this was the issue, the George Floyd killing, the riots, and the kind of language that I was hearing about America is systemically racist and we need to plunder, we need to loot in order to equalize the wealth. And I'm hearing all these things and the cities are on fire. And I thought, well, I need to communicate what I think is true about America and about Christianity in relation to America, and what ideas are terribly wrong and dangerous, and what ideas have helped make America the exceptional nation that it is. So how this will turn out, I don't know. The issue is, are we faithful? Are we hopeful? And there's no reason to panic. I think it was Martin Lloyd-Jones who said, faith is the refusal to panic. So we want to hold fast to what is good and strengthen the things that remain. I want to strengthen everything that's good. about America. But see, a lot of what's good about America is now being called evil. You know, and woe to those who call good evil and evil good, Isaiah 5:20, who exchange darkness for light and light for darkness. I see a lot of that going on right now.
A word from you to the churches, to the pastors, to the reality that the world has our kids 5 days a week, and oftentimes, if anything, the church has them for an hour.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't work. We can't have it that way. So I think the best option is to have children in homeschooling, private schooling, Christian schooling, perhaps in charter schools that still have some decent standards. The public education has just gotten worse and worse, more and more influenced by critical race theory, gender ideology. I've been actually a critic of public schools for literally 40 years. I just reposted an essay I wrote 40 years ago saying that if we want to have a substantial influence on our culture, we need to have a uniquely, distinctively Christian education. And you can't simply counteract everything that's going on in the state schools or everything going on in media with your kids involved with church 1 to 3 hours a week. We have a world and life view. We should have a world view that makes sense of the world, makes sense of history, makes sense of society. And at best, the state schools will teach history and economics and mathematics without any reference to God and without attacking Christian ideals. That's the best you're going to get. The worst, it's going to be actively attacking the Christian view of the family. It's going to be attacking the greatness of America, American exceptionalism, and so on. So I say, let's educate our children and our grandchildren according to Christian principles. Let's teach the Bible and how the Bible relates to economics and politics and all the rest of it. And let's talk about the many exemplary things about the United States as well as our sins. So education is crucial.
Yeah. Fire in the streets. I mean, it's the title of your book, and you talk about how the blaze got started, burning it all down, most combustible topics, a better fire. Talk about the theme of fire, just in a general sense, and how you use this theme to package the book so that you can take the complex and make it relatable, understandable, so we can do something with the information to make a difference while there's yet time.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because when I literally saw the fire in the streets of the riots of 2020, I thought back to a book by James Billington called Fire in the Minds of Men, which was a history of socialism. And I heard myself say, there's fire in the streets because there is fire in the minds of men and women. And it's an unholy fire. It's a fire of revolution. So that stuck with me. And I realized that I needed to write a book about this. And I was interacting with various people. And they said, keep that metaphor of fire going throughout the whole book. And it was very easy to do. So there's unholy fire, burn it down, revolt against the system, pick clear enemies and demonize them, and clear heroes and make them into gods, you know, divide society, the oppressors, the oppressed. And I take that to be bad fire. It's bad history, bad religion, bad everything. So the holy fire is truth and virtue. And that's all we have to work with, is truth and virtue and the power of the Holy Spirit. And thank God the kingdom of God is not bound to America. America can go up in smoke and the kingdom of God marches on. The gates of hell will not prevail against the church. That's what I take my final solace in. And that my final resting place, not resting actually, my final abode, and for any Christian, is the new heavens and the new earth. And that's a place where there are no tears, no curse, where we are with the Lord and with each other and engaging in society and culture without the effects of sin. And what a glorious place that will be. But the only way that's achievable is through the supernatural intervention of God. We want to approximate it. We want to bring as much goodness and mercy and justice to the world we can. But if you try to bring heaven to earth without God, you end up with a living hell. And that's what we saw with the USSR, with Red China, with Cuba, with Cambodia. And sadly, we're seeing that kind of thing in the United States. And it's not the answer.
The answer is in the book, Fire in the Streets, how you can confidently respond to the incendiary cultural topics. Professor Douglas Grotheus, you have done a real service by writing the book, and I don't say that lightly. I read a lot of books. I find this to be an enormously helpful book. And again, I want to mention that this book is available to those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org or when you write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Also, I want to thank you for, as you said, you've been writing articles for the Christian Research Journal and maybe the most prolific contributor to the Christian Research Journal in our history. I want to thank you for that, for the impact you're making on students, for making your voice count. You are certainly making a transcendent difference, and I just want to encourage you to continue doing that, and thank you for your contributions on the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Well, thank you, Hank. I really appreciate it, and appreciate the good work you folks have been doing for all these years.
God bless you, my friend.
Bless you as well.
And again, the book is available on the web at equip.org. You can also get your copy at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Fire in the Streets. It's absolutely critical reading. You can get your copy today as you stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of the podcast.